Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. On today's episode, we will be reading Chapter 8 of Book 2 of The Brothers Karamazov. Did I get that right? Yes. And we will be discussing first Chapter 7, the previous chapter. Here's the questions I asked you guys about Chapter 7. Why do you think Zossima bowed to Dmitri? During speculation about why Ivan might be pursuing Brushenka, Alyosha suggests that perhaps it's suffering he is seeking. What do you think he means by this? Drama going down at the Father Superior's dinner. Does anyone care to hazard a guess as to what happened? Tekrific said Zossima shocks Alyosha by telling him he must leave the monastery. The Starets want Alyosha to become a peacemaker in the family. He also wants him to become a family man himself, to experience life. He adds that he must go through life in order to be able to return to the monastery. That struck me as very insightful. To be prepared for the monastery, you should know life, to have experienced it firsthand. Compare that with the Catholics and their monks, stunted and stultified by a life not lived. Rakitin struck me as the kind of man that sees a lot, understands and intuits a lot, but often draws the wrong conclusions from what he's been able to observe. See, he's so sure he's right and everybody else is wrong. He's also a hypocrite and a cynic. He's clearly broken his celibacy with Grushenka, and the way he's talking to Alyosha about his family shows his true colours. He's as much driven by his passions as the ones he criticises. He's a viper of a man. Dangerous in that he's quick to espouse ideas and seek absolutist solutions. He predicts violence in the Karamazov family's future. Colour me impressed, that's a cold reading anybody could have made except perhaps innocent Alyosha. Rakitin also suspects Zossima is doing his prostration in front of Dmitri so that his reputation among the peasants would increase when the tragedy finally occurs. He suspects Zossima's motive to be nothing less than that of a carnival huckster. So much for pious faith and the nobility of the church. He truly is a cynic at heart. This chapter is not about Alyosha, it's about the man with a career, the seminary Rakitin. The type of man we should recognize. He's the TV evangelist stealing from the poor. He's the socialist who claims to love the proletariat and then sends half of his people off to the gulags. He's the type of man that always seeks a career for himself, and he is always looking out for himself only. He's the eminence gris of every political party, the man in the shadows striving for power, a hunger that can never be satiated. He truly is a dangerous man. Rakitin is Stalin. Both seminarians, both able to justify anything because they feel they have found the answer. They always feel that they are right, and in the right do anything. Sorry for the rant, I had to vent. Rakitins of the world get under my skin. Swim said the mama fish. He said, I think you're being a tad unfair regarding the Catholics and their monks. Roman Catholic monasteries also welcome members who have experienced life and demonstrate they have a vocation. They also accept members who want to enter the life at a young age because they feel they are called by God to enter the religious life. Regardless, there is a multi-step process before one is invited to permanently join a community. Alyosha was in the midst of going through that process, but Zossima concluded that Alyosha was not ready to enter the contemplative life. All right. Starfall said, Pushkin, the poet of women's feet, sung of their feet in his verse. The only information I knew concerning Pushkin is the titles of his works and that he died in a duel, so I looked up his poems concerning women's feet. Poor Pushkin living in cold Russia must have been frustrating. Yeah, I suppose they don't get their feet out very much. And you've gone ahead and copied a poem. A poem here, which I'm going to guess, I'm not going to actually read it. I'm not going to read the poem this once. Usually I would dive in and read the poem, but I'm going to have an early night. So I'm just going to speculate that that poem probably sexualizes, or at least romanticizes, feet. Foot fetish poem. Now, without actually confirming that, I'm going to move on with that accusation lingering. swims to the mum fish. He also said, I found the passage about the magazine very interesting, considering Dostoevsky's biography. Also this, in 1847, Dostoevsky joined a 20-member liberal discussion group that studied liberal French philosophy, professed atheism, and secretly conspired against the Tsar. The group met every Friday to discuss literary and political ideas. Dostoevsky and other serious members in the group planned to put out a reformist magazine on an act of treason at that time. On April 23rd, 1849, Dostoevsky's apartment was raided by police while he was asleep, and he was taken to prison in Peter Paul Fortress in St. Petersburg. After a lengthy interrogation, Dostoevsky said that his subversive remarks had been unintentional and professed his loyalty to Tsar and Church. There was also a lot of talk about sorrow. Consider this. Dostoevsky spent 4 years in chains, from 49 till 1854, at a labour in Omsk, Siberia, doing hard labour, packed like herrings in a barrel, with low-born thieves and murderers. He believed his punishments were deserved. The New Testament was the only reading material he was allowed in prison, and he read it over and over. He suffered a number of epileptic seizures while in prison. Dostoevsky's experience in prison gave him a more positive outlook on life. His religious faith was resurrected in a mystical and humanistic form, in which he equated Christ's suffering with the experience of the Russian working people and the criminals he met in prison. Golly. J. Mummer 8779 said, "Wasn't Ivan pursuing Katerina, not Grushenka? It's Dmitri that is engaged to Katerina, but is pursuing Grushenka." Uncle Drosselmeyer said, "Exactly. It's Katerina Ivanovna." Did I get that wrong? I think I got the names wrong. My bad. Just a clarification, says I Am Norwegian, for the narrator, on why the meeting was held in Zosima's hermitage. The pretext for this gathering was a false one. It was at this time that the discord between Dmitri and his father seemed at its acutest stage, and their relations had become insufferably strained. Fyodor Pavlovich seems to have been the first to suggest, apparently in a joke, that they should all meet in Father Zosima's cell, and that without appealing to his first direct intervention, they might more decently come to an understanding under conciliating influence of the elder's presence. Dmitri, who had never seen the elder, naturally supposed that his father was trying to intimidate him, but as he secretly blamed himself for his outbursts of temper with his father on several recent occasions, he accepted the challenge. You struggling to follow along seems perfectly understandable given the circumstances. Thanks. I'm glad my excuse seems reasonable. I agree that nihilism gets used too lightly. If you had only come in contact with the term through pop culture, you might end up believing that Nietzsche himself was a nihilist and that it's a sort of cool and edgy philosophy for people above silly beliefs, while simultaneously justifying mindless hedonism. It would not surprise me if we discover that nihilistic is an appropriate label for Ivan, though. It's going to be an interesting hearing an apathetic atheist's opinion on this book. Funnily enough, I described myself the same way for many years, even using the exact vernacular, but I ended up nihilistic like you described it, wondering if there truly was a real difference between living or dying. Something Kierkegaard said stuck with me and still does. Hang yourself or not, and you will regret it. It's part of a larger text that gives it more oomph, but it just about summed up my thoughts. This was also clarified when I was coming from... Sorry, this might also clarify where I was coming from in earlier discussions. Oh, and the word for believing that nothing exists except for yourself is solipsism, I believe. That's the one, solipsism. Thank you. Interesting. Very interesting. Thank you, I Am Norwegian, for clarifying my thoughts. They're all muddled up. I think I came really formally in contact with existentialism and nihilism through Albert Camus, The Outsider, or The Stranger, it's sometimes called, different translations. And then I followed up reading a lot of his other books. There was an interesting little catalogue of, like, B-roll books that were almost like his trial and error. Like, he was trying to write The Outsider, Camus, and he wrote these other ones in sort of like, they were like his training grounds. They're like less polished. He's kind of circling around the point that he makes in The Outsider. There's one called A Happy Death, and there is another one whose name escapes me. But I really enjoyed reading all of those works together when I was in my teen years, my late teen years, I'd say, roughly around that time. I think we read The Outsider in year 11, so it would have been about 17, and then over the next couple of years read a lot more of Camus' work. I think having studied Albert Camus' The Outsider in high school, it was actually prescribed reading, that we had to read it. And then being edgy teenagers, a lot of my fellow teenagers, probably even myself included, were like, yeah, I'm totally a nihilist, man. I don't care about nothing. Which might be the root of my disdain for people that claim to be nihilists. I think in a lot of cases, they're just, like you said, trying to be edgy. I Am Norwegian continued, saying, I really enjoyed Zossima telling Alyosha to go out into the world. Someone who knows more than me about Orthodox Christianity, is it atypical to send a young aspiring monk out into the world? It did seem a bit of a surprise to me as well, but like, I think maybe I'm in the same boat as you. I don't really know if that's normal or not. Zossima tells Alyosha to marry. Sounds like the narrator's shipping of Alyosha and Lisa might come to fruition. Wink emoji. Yeah, I reckon it might. Or someone else, you know. But he's going to go out there. He's going to meet a nice girl. The last thing I expected in this book was foot fetishes being brought up, but here we are. Ivan after Dmitri's bride, Katerina Ivanovna. So now we have two love triangles. What a mess. I suspect that Terrific will like Rakitin. It's interesting how quickly we are introduced to someone who mirrors what you have said for the last two discussions. Humanity will find in itself the power to life for virtue, even without believing in immortality. What a range of perspectives in only a few short chapters. We have now reached the last chapter that I've read before discovering this subreddit, so everything from here on out will be new to me, though these chapters have all felt as fresh as they did when I first read them, even if it was barely a month ago. Very cool. All right, well, I Am Norwegian. Glad you've caught up with us, or should say probably we've caught up with you. And I'm looking forward to having this book play out together with all of us, with you as well. Now we march forward one chapter per day. Hold the line, I Am Norwegian. Don't rush ahead again. Savvy Kid said, though I am influenced by Rakitin's explanation now, this is hard to say. At first I thought it was because Zossima wanted to show his sympathies to Dmitri for him being late and being a part of this disheveled family. Now, though, I see it from Rakitin's perspective, but rather divinely influenced. I thought it was a good parallel to how Jesus kissed his betrayer Judas in the Bible, even though Jesus knew that Judas would be the one to betray him later on. I thought Zossima, not saying he is the victim, was pointing out the betrayer amongst them. Perhaps it's suffering he is seeking. Such a beautiful way to describe the often indescribable feeling of pining affections a person can experience for someone totally wrong for them. Yeah, true, hey? Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. You know, when you see someone, they get with someone else and you go, that's just the worst thing for them. It's like they want the problems. And Savvy Kid also said, my only inkling is that Fyodor caused some havoc. Oh, this is Savvy Kid's guess at what the commotion might have been at the Father Superior's dinner. My only inkling is that Fyodor caused some havoc or insulted someone so badly that the dinner had to end. Yeah, I'd say that's a pretty fair guess. Starfall 15 said, although he did say in the last chapter he will leave, but being him, I can imagine showing up again to annoy everyone. Oh, so he didn't go to the dinner. F- Fyodor. Well, that was my guess too. Fyodor would be the one to do the disrupting. But he didn't go to the dinner, so probably not. Samostar said for number two, what was number two? About suffering being the thing that he's seeking. Statements like these are part of why I have difficulty with any argument that goes to extremes. The idea here is that Ivan, because he is unfaithful and tormented by spiritual doubt, seeks suffering. Does anyone seek suffering on purpose? Perhaps I am reading this line too literally, but I can agree with Dostoevsky as I currently understand his intent in this statement. Yeah, I would say people do. People do seek. People have a kind of addiction to drama. That's a real thing. Have you ever met someone who's got an addiction to drama? They'll tell you till they're blue in the face that they hate drama, that they try to avoid drama. It's a bit of a red flag. If anyone ever tells you that they hate drama, they are probably the kind of person who has a mild or even a severe addiction to drama, and they actually surround themselves with it. They draw it into them, or they even create it themselves. Not that I'm speaking from personal experience or anything like that. I've never met anyone like that. HenryLoz70 said, question 3, I am guessing that the quarrel continued and that they might have challenged each other to a duel. Wow, okay, some War and Peace stuff going on here. So this is the commotion that this whatever happened at the dinner, and they're getting ready for a duel. I truly hope that that's what's happening, because I want another duel. That duel scene in War and Peace, if anyone else was here for that, come out of a year in War and Peace, that was a cool scene. That was really exciting. Let's hope that happens again. All right. That is the conversation part of the podcast complete. Sorry, a bit of a rush through it today. Tomorrow is the big day, the big launch party. I've got it might be 100, it might be 200. I've got no idea how many people are going to be there tomorrow, but a lot of excited kids, a lot of excited parents, a lot of excited grandparents and teachers and etc. And I feel very underprepared. I'm a little bit nervous about it. I'm a little bit anxious, I think is the word. I really feel like I'm forgetting major things, or like I'm just going to be dealing with the complaints more than anything. Like, if, you know, there probably won't be any complaints. But, you know, you just imagine that you're just being bombarded by 100 people saying, well, this isn't right. Oh, we've run out of this. Oh, there's no this in the that. Oh, it's too hot. Oh, it's too cold. Oh, this person's fallen over and is dead now. Etc. Things like that. So, that's what I'm anticipating. Most likely it'll just be a bunch of people sitting around appreciating a book that's been created. But you know how it is when you're in charge of a big event. You just kind of anticipate the worst for no particular reason. All right, I am rambling now, so let's move forward. Let us read The Brothers Karamazov, Book 2, Chapter 8. Chapter 8, The Scandalous Scene. Yusuf, as a man of breeding and delicacy, could not but feel some inward qualms when he reached the father's superiors with Ivan. He felt ashamed of having lost his temper. He felt that he ought to have disdained the despicable wretch, Fyodor Pavlovich, too much to have been upset by him in Father Zossima's cell, and so to have forgotten himself. The monks were not to blame in any case, he reflected on the steps, and if they're decent people here, and the Father Superior, I understand, is a nobleman, why not be friendly and courteous with them? I won't argue. I'll fall in with everything. I'll win them by politeness and show them that I have nothing to do with that Asoph, that buffoon, that Pierrot, and have merely been taken in over this affair just as they have. He determined to drop his litigation with the monastery and relinquish his claims to the wood-cutting and fishery rights at once. He was the more ready to do this because the rights had become much less valuable, and he had indeed the vaguest idea where the wood and river in question were. These excellent intentions were strengthened when he entered the Father Superior's dining room, though, strictly speaking, It was not a dining room, for the Father Superior had only two rooms altogether. They were, however, much larger and more comfortable than Father Zossima's. But there was no great luxury about the furnishing of these rooms either. The furniture was of mahogany covered with leather in the old-fashioned style of 1820, and the floor was not even stained, but everything was shining with cleanliness, and there were many choice flowers in the windows. The most sumptuous thing in the room at that moment was, of course, the beautiful decorated table. The cloth was clean, the service shone, there were three kinds of well-baked bread, two bottles of wine, two of excellent mead, and a large glass jug of kvass. But the latter made in the monastery and famous in their neighbourhood. There was no vodka. Rakitin related afterwards that there were five dishes: fish soup made of sterlets served with little fish patties, then boiled fish served in a special way, then salmon cutlets, ice pudding and compote, and finally blanc mange. Rakitin found out about all these good things, for he could not resist peeping into the kitchen, where he already had a footing. He had a footing everywhere, and got information about everything. He was of an uneasy and envious temper. He was well aware of his own considerable abilities, and nervously exaggerated them in his self-conceit. He knew he would play a prominent part of some sort, but Alyosha, who was attached to him, was distressed to see that his friend Rakitin was dishonourable, and quite unconscious of being so himself, considering, on the contrary, that because he would not steal money left on the table, he was a man of the highest integrity. Neither Alyosha nor anyone else could have influenced him on that. Rakitin, of course, was a person of too little consequence to be invited to the dinner, to which Father Yusuf, Father Pacey, and one other monk were the only inmates of the monastery invited. They were already waiting when Yusuf, Kalganov, and Ivan arrived. The other guest, Maximov, stood a little aside, waiting also. The Father Superior stepped into the middle of the room to receive his guests. He was a tall, thin, but still vigorous old man, with black hair streaked with grey, and a long, grave, ascetic face. He bowed to his guests in silence, but this time they approached to receive his blessing. Yusuf even tried to kiss his hand, but the Father Superior drew it back in time to avoid the salute. But Ivan and Kalganov went through the ceremony in the most simple-hearted and complete manner, kissing his hand as peasants do. "We must apologize most humbly, Your Reverence," began Yusuf, simpering affably and speaking in a dignified and respectful tone. "Pardon us for having come alone, without the gentleman you invited, Fyodor Pavlovich. He felt obliged to decline the honour of your hospitality, and not without reason. In the Reverend Father Zossima's cell, he was carried away by the unhappy dissension with his son, and let fall words which were quite out of keeping, in fact quite unseemly, as," he glanced at the monks, "Your Reverence is no doubt already aware. And therefore, recognizing that he had been to blame, he felt sincere regret and shame, and begged me and his son Ivan Fyodorovitch to convey to you his apologies and regrets. In brief, he hopes and desires to make amends later. He asks your blessing and begs you to forget what has taken place." As he uttered the last word of his tirade, Yusuf completely recovered his self-complacency, and all traces of his former irritation disappeared. He fully and sincerely loved humanity again. The Father Superior listened to him with dignity, and with a slight bend of the head, replied, "I sincerely deplore his absence. Perhaps at our table he might have learned to like us, and we him. Pray be seated, gentlemen." He stood before the holy image and began to say grace aloud. All bent their heads reverently, and Maximov clasped his hand before him with peculiar fervor. It was at this moment that Fyodor Pavlovich played his last prank. It must be noted that he really had meant to go home, and really had felt the impossibility of going to dine with the Father Superior, as nothing had happened. After his disgraceful behaviour in the elder's cell, not that he was so very much ashamed of himself, quite the contrary, perhaps, but still he felt it would be unseemly to go to dinner. Yet his creaking carriage had hardly been brought to the steps of the hotel, and he had hardly gotten into it, when he suddenly stopped short. He remembered his own words at the elders. "I always feel, when I meet people, that I am lower than all, and that they all take me for a buffoon. So I say, let me play the buffoon, for you are, every one of you, stupider and lower than I." He longed to revenge himself on everyone for his own unseemliness. He suddenly recalled how he had once in the past been asked, "Why do you hate so-and-so so much?" And he had answered them with his shameless impudence, "I'll tell you, he has done me no harm, but I played him a dirty trick, and ever since I have hated him." Remembering that now, he smiled quietly and malignantly, hesitating for a moment. His eyes gleamed and his lips positively quivered. "Well, since I have begun, I may as well go on," he decided. His predominant sensation at that moment might be expressed in the following words. "Well, there is no rehabilitating myself now, so let me shame them for all I am worth. I will show them I don't care what they think, that's all." He told the coachman to wait, while with rapid steps he returned to the monastery and straight to the Father Superior's. He had no clear idea what he would do, but he knew that he could not control himself and that a touch might drive him to the utmost limits of obscenity, but only to obscenity, to nothing criminal, nothing for which he could be legally punished. In that last resort he could always restrain himself, and had marvelled indeed at himself on that score. Sometimes he appeared in the Father Superior's dining room at the moment when the prayer was over, and all were moving to the table. Standing in the doorway, he scanned the company, and laughing his prolonged, impudent, malicious chuckle, looked at them all boldly in the face. "They thought I had gone, but here I am again," he cried to the whole room. For one moment everyone stared at him without a word, and at once everyone felt that something revolting, grotesque, positively scandalous was about to happen. Musoff passed immediately from the most benevolent frame of mind to the most savage. All the feelings that had subsided and died down in his heart revived instantly. "No, this I cannot endure," he cried. "Absolutely I cannot, and I certainly cannot." The blood rushed to his head. He positively stammered, but he was beyond thinking of style, and he seized his hat. "What is it he cannot?" cried Fyodor Pavlovich, "that he absolutely cannot and certainly cannot? Your reverence, am I to come in or not? Will you receive me as your guest?" "You are welcome with all my heart," answered the superior. "Gentlemen," he added, "I venture to beg you most earnestly to lay aside your dissensions and to be united in love and family harmony, with prayer to the Lord, at our humble table." "No, no, it is impossible," cried Musoff, beside himself. "Well, if it is impossible for Peter Alexandrovitch, it is impossible for me, and I won't stop. That is why I came. I will keep with Peter Alexandrovitch everywhere now. If you will go away, Peter Alexandrovitch, I will go away too. If you remain, I will remain." "You stung him by what you said about family harmony, Father Superior. He does not admit he is my relation." "That's right, isn't it, von Sonn?" "Here's von Sonn. How are you, von Sonn?" "Do you mean me?" muttered Maximov, puzzled. "Of course I mean you," cried Fyodor Pavlovich. "Who else? The Father Superior could not be von Sonn." "But I am not von Sonn either. I'm Maximov." "No, you are von Sonn. Your reverence, do you know who von Sonn was? It was a famous murder case. He was killed in a house of harlotry. I believe that is what such places are called among you. He was killed and robbed, and in spite of his venerable age, he was nailed up in a box and sent from Petersburg to Moscow in the luggage van, and while they were nailing him up, the harlots sang songs and played the harp, that is to say, the piano. So this is that very von Sonn. He has risen from the dead, hasn't he, von Sonn?" "What is happening? What is this?" voices were heard in the group of monks. "Let us go," cried Musov, addressing Kalganov. "No, excuse me," Fyodor Pavlovich broke in shrilly, taking another step into the room. "Allow me to finish. There, in the cell, you blamed me for behaving disrespectfully just because I spoke of eating gudgeon. Peter Alexandrovitch, Musov, my relation, prefers to have plus de noblesse que de sincerity in his words, but I prefer in mine plus de sincerity de que noblesse, and damn the nobles." "That's right, isn't it, von Sonn? Allow me, Father Superior, though I am a buffoon, and play the buffoon, yet I am the soul of honour, and I want to speak my mind. yes, I am the soul of honour, while in Peter Alexandrovich there is wounded vanity and nothing else. I came here perhaps to have a look and speak my mind. My son Alexei is here, being saved. I am his father, I care for his welfare, and it is my duty to care. While I've been playing the fool, I have been listening, and having a look on the sly, and now I want to give you the last act of the performance. You know how things are with us. As a thing falls, so it lies. As a thing once has fallen, so it must lie forever. Not a bit of it. I want to get up again, Holy Father, I am indignant with you. Confession is a great sacrament, before which I am ready to bow down reverently, but there in the cell, they all kneel down and confess aloud. Can it be right to confess aloud? It was ordained by the Holy Fathers to confess in secret. Then only your confessions will be a mystery, and so it was of old. But how can I explain to him before everyone that I did this and that? Well, you understand what. Sometimes it would not be proper to talk about it, so it is rarely a scandal. Really a scandal. No, fathers, one might be carried along with you to the flagellants, I dare say. At the first opportunity I shall write to the synod, and I shall take my son, Alexei, home. We must note here that Fyodor Pavlovich knew where to look for the weak spot. There had been at one time malicious rumours which had even reached the archbishop, not only regarding our monastery, but in others were the institution of elders existed. That too much respect was paid to the elders, even to the detriment of the authority of the superior. That the elders abused the sacrament of confession, and so on, absurd charges which had died away of themselves everywhere. But the spirit of folly, which had caught up Fyodor Pavlovich, and was bearing him on the current of his own nerves into lower and lower depths of ignominy, prompted him with this old slander. Fyodor Pavlovich did not understand a word of it, and he could not even put it sensibly, for on this occasion no one had been kneeling and confessing aloud in the elder's cell, so that he could not have seen anything of the kind. He was only speaking from confused memory of old slanders, but as soon as he had uttered his foolish tirade, he felt he had been talking absurd nonsense, and at once longed to prove to his audience, and above all to himself, that he had not been talking nonsense. And though he knew perfectly well that with each word he would be adding more and more absurdity, he could not restrain himself and plunged forward blindly. "How disgraceful!" cried Peter Alexandrovich. "Pardon me," said the Father Superior. "It was said of old, many have begun to speak against me and have uttered evil sayings about me, and hearing it I have said to myself, it is the correction of the Lord, and he has sent it to heal my vain soul. And so we humbly thank you, honoured guest," and he made Fyodor Pavlovich a low bow. "Tut, tut, tut, sanctimoniousness and stock phrases and old gestures, the old lies and formal prostrations. We know all about them, a kiss on the lips and a dagger in the heart, as the Schiller's robbers. I don't like falsehood, fathers, I want the truth. But the truth is not to be found in eating gudgeon, and that I proclaim aloud. Father monks, why do you fast? Why do you expect reward in heaven for that? Why, for a reward like that I will come and fast too. No, saintly monk, you try being virtuous in the world. Do good to society without shutting yourself up in a monastery at other people's expense and without expecting a reward aloft for it. You'll find that a bit harder. I can talk sense too, Father Superior. What have they got here?" He went up to the table. "Old port wine, mead brewed by the Eliseev brothers. Fee, fee, fathers, that is something beyond gudgeon. Look at the bottles the fathers have brought out. He, he, he. And who has provided it all? The Russian peasant, the labourer, brings here the farthing earned by his horny hand, wringing it from his family, and the tax-gatherer. You bleed the people, you know, holy fathers." "This is too disgraceful," said Father Yusuf. Father Pacey kept obstinately silent. Yusuf rushed from the room, and Kalganov after him. "Well, Father, I will follow Peter Alexandrovich. I am not coming to see you again. You may beg me on your knees, I shan't come. I sent you 1,000 rubles, so you have begun to keep your eye on me. Ha, ha, ha. No, I will say no more. I am taking my revenge for my youth, for all the humiliation I endured. He thumped the table with his fist in paroxysm of simulated feeling. This monastery has played a great part in my life. It has cost me many bitter tears. You used to set my wife, the crazy one, against me. You cursed me with bowel and book, and you spread stories about me all over the place. Enough, fathers. This is the age of liberalism, the age of steamers and railways. Neither 1,000 nor 100 rubles, nor 100 farthings will you get out of me. It must be noted again that our monastery never had played any great part in his life, and he never had shed a bitter tear owing to it, but he was so carried away by his simulated emotion that he was for one moment almost believing it himself. He was so touched, he was almost weeping, but at that very instant he felt that it was time to draw back. The Father Superior bowed his head at a malicious lie and again spoke impressively. It is written again, bear circumspectly and gladly dishonour that cometh upon thee by no act of thine own. Be not confounded, and hate not him who hath dishonoured thee. And so will we. Tut, 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 bethinking thyself and the rest of the rigmarole, bethink yourself, fathers, I will go. But I will take my son, Alexei, away from here forever, on my parental authority. Ivan Fyodorovitch, my most dutiful son, permit me to order you to follow me. Vonson, what have you to stay for? Come and see me now in the town. It is fun there. It is only one short verst. Instead of a Lenten oil, I will give you sucking pig and kasha. We will have dinner with some brandy and liquor to it. I have cloudberry wine. Hey, Vonson, don't lose your chance, he went out, shouting and gesticulating. It was at that moment Rakitin saw him and pointed him out to Alyosha. Alexei, his father shouted from far off, catching sight of him, you come home to me today for good, and bring your pillow and mattress and leave no trace behind. Alyosha stood rooted to the spot, watching the scene in silence. Meanwhile, Fyodor Pavlovich had got into the carriage, and Ivan was about to follow him in grim silence, without even turning to say goodbye to Alyosha. But at this point, another almost incredible sense of grotesque buffoonery gave the finishing touch to the episode. Maximov suddenly appeared by the side of the carriage. He ran up, panting, afraid of being too late. Rakitin and Alyosha saw him running. He was in such a hurry that in his impatience he put his foot on the step on which Ivan's left foot was still resting, and clutching the carriage he kept trying to jump in. I am going with you, he kept shouting. Laughing, a thin, mirthful laugh with a look of reckless glee in his face. Take me too. There, cried Fyodor Pavlovich, delighted. Did I not say he was Vonson? It is Vonson himself, risen from the dead. Why, how did you tear yourself away? What did you Vonson there? And how could you get away from the dinner? You must be a brazen-faced fellow. I am that myself, but I am surprised at you, brother. Jump in. Let him pass, Ivan. It will be fun. He can lie somewhere at our feet. Will you lie at our feet, Vonson? Or perch on the box with the coachman? Skip on to the box, Vonson. But Ivan, who had by now taken his seat without a word, gave Maximov a violent punch in the breast and sent him flying. It was quite by chance he did not fall. Drive on, Ivan shouted angrily to the coachman. Why, what are you doing? What are you about? Why did you do that? Fyodor Pavlovich protested. But the carriage had already driven away. Ivan made no reply. Well, you are a fellow, Fyodor Pavlovich said again. After a pause of 2 minutes, looking askance at his son, why, it was you got up all this monastery business. You urged it. You approved of it. Why are you angry now? You've talked rot enough. You might rest a bit now, Ivan suddenly snapped sullenly. Fyodor Pavlovich was silent again for 2 minutes. A drop of brandy would be nice, he observed, sententiously. But Ivan made no response. You shall have some too when we get home. Ivan was still silent. Fyodor Pavlovich waited another 2 minutes. But I shall take Alyosha away from the monastery, though you will dislike it so much, most honoured Karl von Moor. Ivan shrugged his shoulders contemptuously and, turning away, stared at the road, and they did not speak again all the way home. All right, there we go. That is the end of chapter, what was it, seven of book two. And indeed, it was actually the end of book two. So in tomorrow's episode, we'll be continuing on to read chapter one of book three. Exciting stuff. We're moving through at a blistering pace. Have your say about this chapter over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I very much look forward to hearing your thoughts. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.